Welcome to the Visions of a Better World podcast. Today we're joined by Professor Franklin Obeng-Odum, a professor of global development studies at the University of Helsinki, Dr. Bon Huego, a political economist and senior lecturer at the University of Jyväskylä, as well as the current chair of the Finnish Society for Development Research. And we also have Dr. Faith Mekwesha, a researcher at the University of Turku and the founder of Sahuira Africa International, a non-profit advocating for women's and children's rights. So thank you everyone for being here today and traveling to come and see us here. I thought that we would begin just by checking in with all of you. It's a new year after all, and I think we are already seeing new challenges for the Global South, even though we're only in February. So I thought perhaps we could start by you each sharing your greatest current concern for the countries and communities in the Global South as we look into 2025. And is there something that you feel is underrepresented in current discussions or not shown in the media? Dr. Faith, would you like to begin?
Okay, thank you very much for inviting us. I'm very happy to participate in this discussion. What makes me not sleep well is the global inequalities, and especially with the focus on Africa. I think when we get into any discussions about the Global South, we have to really talk about the story of the inequalities that are existing. There's a lot of poverty in Africa. There's wars that are going on that are causing a lot of disruption. And most of the problems that we have from a post-colonial, decolonial perspective, we cannot fail to talk about slavery, colonialism, and its impact of the crisis that we have in the Global South. So for me, I've been engaged in a lot of activism on representation of Black people, especially Africa and the Africans, because the representation also participates in creating certain images that filter the reality of what is happening in the Global South. I'm also very much interested in post-colonial theory, decolonial theory, Black African feminism. They help to understand at a more critical level the causes of the inequalities that are happening and the legacy of slavery and colonialism. And if we look at that from a decolonial intersectional perspective, it helps us to think more about the solutions. So this is what makes me not sleep. And it causes me not to sleep because we know that the majority of the young people in 2050, according to the United Nations, is in the Global South. So if we are going to have 85% of the working population in 2050 from the Global South, then it means we really have to start to be serious to think about how can we make sure that the Global South is supported, especially in the case of Africa. How can we really support the young people there to develop the actual skills and tools that can help them to participate in the global economy in a meaningful way. If we do not do that, so we will continue to have serious poverty, and we will continue to have conflict because of economic inequalities, which trigger conflict. For example, if we look at what Zimbabwe, where I come from, Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for more than 20 years. And the sanctions came because of taking back land without compensation that happened in Zimbabwe. And the land conflict was the cause of the wars that happened of decolonization. And when we became independent, there was no equal distribution of land. And then it caused that what they called the third Chimurenga, which meant taking back the land without compensation. So because of that, there were sanctions which have destroyed the economy. Now we have like 90% of the people are not working. There's no employment. Most of the people are involved in informal employment, of selling things and so forth, which is like most African countries. So you can see that the whole legacy of colonialism, of taking land and from the indigenous people, and then causing war, and then causing the third Chimurenga, taking back this land, has led to sanctions, and these sanctions have led to the destruction of the economy. So if you have a country that has got more than 18 million people, and it has 90% unemployed, we are obviously just waiting for small trigger for huge conflict. If you go in DRC, we also have a war that just started, which has been going on, but now it started intensively. It's going on right now. What is the cause? It's the cause is also colonialism. People were separated. An ethnic group that belongs to Rwanda is in DRC and so forth. And now we have huge conflicts. And then we have constant movement of people, displacement, which also causes conflict. So if this continues, it's not only DRC. If this continues, we have it in Sudan, we have it in Somalia. We have so many displacements in a huge continent, which is growing continent with a huge potential for global economy. If there is what we call decolonial reflexivity from the global north, there's need for decolonial reflexivity to think about how can we contribute in solving some of the conflict of the problems we created during the Berlin Conference in 1884. We created huge conflict when there was the partitioning of Africa, and that partitioning of Africa is what is causing the impact that we have right now. But there is a good opportunity if we can really be courageous and get into decolonial reflexivity and then think about solutions. We owe it to Africa so that we can create a better society for Africa. And then it can contribute to the global society. Africa has got a huge percent of the minerals that the world needs. So we need stability there. So these are the things that keep me awake. I'll think as the discussion goes on, I'll talk about the solutions that I think we can have so that we can solve some of the huge problems we are having in Africa. I'm an African black woman. I'm a mother. So I'm very passionate about these problems because I have children who are even there in Zimbabwe. So we want to have serious thinking about the positionality of Africa in the global economy.
Thank you, Dr. Faith. We also last year actually had a discussion with someone from Zimbabwe who was a representative of the Debt for Climate activist movement, and he was also explaining the exact same thing with this unemployment and just all these people who are young and have so much potential, but then there just is not a job for them to do, and especially not having good jobs.
And there was very high quality education. Zimbabwe in Africa, it's one of the best quality education. So we have more than 90% are literate. And that was the gift that independence kind of gave the country. Mm. So we have these highly educated people. We have no hope at all. Obviously, we are just waiting for one thing. Then there's falling apart that can happen. So I think we need to think as well about what these sanctions mean. When the West imposes these sanctions, do they think about the ordinary people? Because even if we have politicians who are not practicing democracy as defined by the West, or who are not practicing human rights as defined by the West, but who is really going to suffer? I think the ordinary people are the ones who are suffering more with some of these sanctions that are put in place. And if we look at the global relations, I think the West owes it to Africa, I think, about restitution of slavery, colonialism. Mm. So I think even if there is any problem that can happen, I think sanctions like sanctions on Zimbabwe need to be removed. Sanctions on any African country need to be removed. And then we can think about how do we support countries to practice democracy, because you can't impose democracy in a country that is 90% of people are not working. They have no money, they have no food. Mm. How do you talk about democracy. So if we really want democracy to thrive, then we have to think about the imposition of sanctions. We have to think about how some of these wars are destabilizing communities. We have to think about how women and children become the center of the suffering that happens during this crisis. So I'm happy that we have been having these discussions, because this is the only way we can think about the way to improve some of these global crises that we have.
Thank you. Who would like to continue? Bon.
Yeah, my greatest concern for the Global South countries, and we're talking about generalities here and collectivities, is capitalism. It's the most urgent that I see. Specifically how competitive capitalism is evolving, developing unevenly, and taking different forms from country to country, from state to state, from society to society within the Global South. But the Global South should be understood not simply as a geographical position in the world map, but its current condition in relation to the evolution of the capitalist world system and world economy. In general, today's capitalism is resulting in the deepening of insecurities, particularly for ordinary people in economically and technologically weak countries in the Global South. These insecurities are alarmingly manifested in the multiple dimensions of capitalism, or the pressures of capitalist competition. The obvious dimension in capitalism is the class and economic dimension. Faith already mentioned, not just in Africa, but also in Latin America and Asia. Even here in the Global North, it's just widening inequalities between the rich and the poor, the elites and the masses. And of course, the class dimension entails the continuing and precariousness and exploitability of the working class and the working people. And the second dimension is the cultural. Culturally, we have witnessed how capitalism is evolving in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America. You go to your social media pages, the changes of mindset and sense of living. What we are seeing is the subjectification and objectification of people, not as human beings, but as exploitable or exploitive market actor, market agents, or neoliberal citizens, as we call it. Part of the cultural dimension includes the whole aspect of the social reproduction aspect. I mean, institutions is part of the social reproduction aspect. And I refer here to the education systems and social policies and the media. They are all oriented towards the capitalistic ethos. And then, as I said, in developing countries, we see the rise of platform economies. We are observing more and more tens of millions of people, especially the youth, aspiring to be social media influencers, basically with the ethos of individualism, which is capitalistic, together with materialism and consumerism. And the third dimension would be politically and governmentality in the Global South. So capitalism is unfolding not with good elements of liberalism, as the hyper-globalists or the ones proponents of globalization are saying, but not even at least the good aspects of liberal democracy, but with ultra-conservatism, right-wing populism, and authoritarianism. So what we are seeing is the embedding of capitalism in different political regimes. What we are seeing in Global South is the proliferation of authoritarian regimes and really conservative populist public. And that, for me, is a very alarming trend in the Global South. The fourth dimension we should not forget about capitalism is the technological. And it is really serious, because I see the threat really are the big tech oligarchs. But we should also not romanticize the Global South, because there are also oppressive regimes and governments in the region. So both of them, big tech oligarchs and authoritarian regimes, are resorting to the digital form of capitalism and now what we call surveillance capitalism. So this violates human dignity as we know it, as individuals and also as workers. There have been many research now emerging that see that technological aspect of capitalism. And then the fifth dimension, of course, is geopolitical. So capitalism, I argue, of course, capitalism also intersects with what Faith is saying, with race and also gender. But the material basis of and the driving force of colonialism, continuing colonialism, the driving force and the material basis of wars, including genocides, the crimes against humanity still happening in the Global South, and a lot of resource conflicts, they are based on capitalism. So the Global South is and will be very vulnerable to the geopolitical rivalry between the United States and China.
Mm.
As someone from the Philippines, we observed that, the tension in the South China Sea and the U.S. presence still there. We all know that there's now a rupture in the global order. The United States is losing its hegemony. We are technically moving towards a more multipolar world, which is ideal. And the Trump phenomenon at the moment is also just a recent manifestation. Trump is unpredictable, but we can reserve the observation in this regard. But my point here with regard to the Global South is that the threat of war is there. And even though there's a decline of hegemony of the United States, it won't be so easy for the U.S. to give up its superiority. It will really fight toe-to-toe, whatever it takes. And who will be vulnerable? As I said, the economically and technologically weak Global South countries, which will be caught to the real threat of nuclear annihilation. And then the last dimension, which is obvious, often talked about, is climate change. Mm. Lots of research, well-established, well-known, that the Global South, the region where I come from, Southeast Asia, one of the most vulnerable, if not the most vulnerable or the greatest victims of the history of climate injustice. So in short, I think my biggest concern is the monster of capitalism, its multifaceted spheres developing differently and unevenly in countries of the Global South.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm concerned that the world is now less sustainable as it's becoming more unequal. The Global South has sometimes closed this inequality gap, but Africa has been an outcast. Per capita incomes and per capita wealth are much lower there. Some of its countries, cities, and regions are the most unequal in the world. Africa is among the least contributors to the global ecological crisis, but it is barrier grounds of extinction. The drivers of these trends seem to have received a new lease of life. The concentration of wealth and power in the global north, rising anti-immigration sentiment, and imperial nostalgia. In my opinion, these are sobering times.
Mm.
Yeah, I think I would also want to add to what Bonnie and Frank were saying by bringing in the intersectionality of capitalism, and we bring in gender, and we bring in race, and we bring in all the different groups of people that groups dynamics that become victims of the biggest monster, which is capitalism. But if we look at it from an intersectional perspective, then we can see that race becomes very central, because why we end up with this huge crisis of racism is because of from slavery, they had to justify why you can enslave another group of people. You have to take away their humanity and really make everyone convinced that they are not human. And we see that this dehumanization becomes very central to the crisis that we are encountering. Once the humanity is removed, then we can have that intersectionality with the genocide and all these problems that we're having. So I think it is really important to look at some of these crises that we're having with an intersectional perspective. If we are going to have a World War III, which group is going to be really survive? There's no one who's going to survive. But the majority of the people will just be suffering when they've not even the weapons of mass destruction, they don't have many countries. So I think we are in a situation that needs a lot of decolonial reflexivity.
Thank you, Dr. Faith. Let's move on to a question for Franklin. And of course, this will also be on the theme of capitalism, but I framed it as neoliberalism. So in your work, you've been quite critical of the growth narrative that kind of rebrands Africa in terms of GDP potential, because now it seems to be a bit of a buzzword. You wrote in one of your articles that Africa has been rebranded in this kind of buzzword GDP potential growth mindset type of lens. But while they do that, then it disregards the creation of sustainable jobs and well-being of people. So can you talk a bit about this critique and some of the problems with current neoliberal models of development policy? Thank you.
The nature of neoliberal development policy is as straightforward as President Trump's Middle Eastern policy. But neoliberal commitment to growth is more lucid. That said, the strident pursuit of economic growth is shared with humanists and radical development policies. One replaces bad news with growth news, the other growth with degrowth. For me, prioritizing growth or degrowth or whatever growth, green growth or whatever, marginalizes more fundamental concerns. Monopoly, social stratification, and even ecological crisis. This is why I don't particularly support the analysis of the ongoing transformation in growth terms.
Mm. Is there something in that you would then shift to talk about instead, or would you wish people would learn more about instead of the growth narrative? Then is are there any other options that are floating around, for example, on even a smaller community level, where the jobs can become sustainable and well-being and this type of politics of care?
If we start from the basis that there are more fundamental problems than economic growth, then alternatives will be those that prioritize local needs, those that support more ecological transformation. Typically, these alternatives are not particularly radical. They are less revolutionary and more evolutionary. In Indonesia, this is called industrial downstreaming. A particular approach to development policy centered on the state and focused on driving down exclusion, domesticating prosperity, reducing unsustainability, which is centered on transnational corporation-led development or economic growth processes. Lagos State and the city of Lagos have diversified away from fossil-led development, although Nigeria, the country in which it is based, is still strongly dependent on fossil. Lagos State now prioritizes indigenous local economic development processes. What is notable or promising about these alternatives is not that they are flawless, but that they prioritize local economic and ecological processes.
Okay.
There has been a recent book on Lagos, poignantly titled Economic Diversification in Nigeria. And yeah, I encourage listeners and colleagues to read the book.
Thank you.
I've written my own review of the book in the Review of Black Political Economy, but better get the book and read it for yourself.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. This is a subject actually that we've talked about before with Bon, but in our event last year, you discussed this big challenge that we have, and especially in Finland, which is the problem of insularity, where in countries like Finland, people do not want to, they don't think that the problems that affect the global south and other countries affect them, and they want to, we want to kind of cut ourselves off from the rest of the world in a sense. We want to concentrate on our small country. You have emphasized in your talk how global challenges like climate change will, of course, as you mentioned, disproportionately affect the global south first, but ultimately will impact us all. So why should countries like Finland and others have a sense of global responsibility? And I think especially in the Finnish context, it's important to say that we often hear that, oh, well, America or Britain are responsible for all of the problems in these countries. But of course, I think that that's maybe one of the biggest arguments why they don't understand that we are all a part of the systems that still continue to create these inequalities and still continue to oppress people in these countries and, of course, do not support them with these big challenges that we're facing. So there's a long question for you again.
I'm always asked why, Bon, why do you problematize insularity when the real problem in countries like Finland and many parts of Europe is racism, as what Faith has eloquently discussed. For me, I'm also a student of right-wing populism, and I'm a researcher in development studies, and I prioritize also development communication. By development communication, I mean not just information dissemination, but the goal really is about consciousness raising. Because strategically in communicating, if you say the problem is racism, sometimes having lived in Finland for a long time, it's a way of really just creating your own bubbles, just ignoring, you know, sometimes people are sensitive, they just don't want to engage, or it's very antagonistic as a starting point. So, for instance, if I always think about it, how can we communicate and have a dialogue? So I take racism on the side in a discussion by say, okay, I think let's just talk about the problem of insularity. Now in Finland, if you read the news coming here, I read in Ule News that the Finns party minister for health said that the Finnish healthcare system will collapse without migrant workers. So this kind of realization and opening up is also coming in. I problematize insularity because we cannot make sense of the past, present, and future of our individual and collective existence without a global perspective for our global strategy toward a global vision. Internationalism or globalism is an antidote to serious diseases of racism, individualism, and nationalism that we observe that all over the world, those diseases. Insularity means that you are only concerned with and interested in your own experience, your own culture, your own nation, your own community, without understanding the interconnectivity and interdependence of the causes and solutions to your or our problems. So how did countries like Finland, the advanced countries, develop? We should understand it in terms of its position and relation in the evolving world economy. The supply chains and market, those are just not just matters of within the boundaries of Finland. Issues that Finland are facing at the moment are global phenomena. The economic stagnation, prolonged economic stagnation. This week, I'm probably celebrating my 11th year in Finland. Mm. I have observed it's really stagnating for a decade with high unemployment and then terrible youth unemployment in the country. But these are just manifestation and symptoms of what's really happening in the world economy. And also the kind of the capitalist development that Finland is leading to. The problem of climate change is, as we know, global carbon emissions. So others would say that you hear that in Finland, well, I'm a green voter. I used to be a green voter. I'm for the environment, I buy organic, I support our local farmers. But if you don't understand your environmentalism and how it's connected to the global environment and climate, you don't really make any sense and you don't have an ethos of solidarity. And then what are the other serious problems in Europe, including in Finland? Mass migration, asylum seekers, and refugees. Those are creating domestic tensions, but these are global phenomenon. It's just so easy to say the liberalist argument of I am pro or anti-immigration. You sound good if you're pro-immigration, but that liberalist argument misses the fundamental issue. Asking the question, why are the Africans, North Africans, Middle Easterns, and Arabs here?
Mm.
They are fleeing conditions of war and maldevelopment.
Mm.
That's the fundamental issue. And who caused those imperialist wars and maldevelopment? To be frank, these are the allies of Finland at the moment.
Mm.
And that should give a greater sense of responsibility to a country like Finland. Being part of the European Union, Finland doesn't have a colonial history. Well, colleagues have been enlightening me, especially this week. It's very important to recognize the Sami people, the Sami Day or the Sami Week. They say that Finland is guilty of colonialism in that part of, in northern Finland. But historically, Finland was not a colonial master. So it excuses itself from charges of white supremacy or racial colonialism. But then it's part of the European Union. And also, if you look at where development aid money goes, from Finland, the number one where money goes, it's not direct to governments, not to civil society. These are to multilateral organizations. So World Bank and then the IMF, who are these multilateral institutions? These were the culprit of bringing about neoliberalism, the conditionalities, the structural adjustment programs that have been imposed on the third world countries, the highly indebted countries. So you can say that directly or indirectly through their development investments, coursed through multilaterals, also impacted the underdevelopment and the maldevelopment in the global south. So that's one of the conditions of mass migration, because you have already destroyed the industries, manufacturing base, including the agricultural base of the global south countries. So they are also fleeing conditions of maldevelopment, underdevelopment. And then who carried out imperialist wars? Well, now Finland is a member of NATO, ally of the United States. So the more that the country should be responsible to receive refugees and asylum seekers coming from those communities which they have bombed and whose population they have decimated. So these are really serious issues where Finland should understand its position in the world, you know, its relationship with the allies and also its relationship with the larger world. And then, of course, why insularity is a problem, because it's based on, in philosophy, it's called the contract of mutual indifference. You're insensitive, you know, practical unconcern to the conditions of the others. That's what racism is also. That's what capitalism is. Racism and capitalism, or one of the features that unite them, is that they do not care about the well-being of others. And of course, our vision for the world is to have a more caring future.
Thank you. Yet it feels like both of them share the anti-equality bottom line, that someone's better than someone else in that discussion or paradigm. But if we think of just on a societal level in Finland now, Dr. Faith, you've worked with the concepts of anti-racism and intersectionality. So why should we consider these when we discuss the global south, and what needs to be done in countries like Finland, which, as we know, is one of the, or is it the most racist country in Europe, according to some studies? How can we build greater understanding and empathy towards the global south? Can this type of, like, learning about anti-racism and intersectionality, can they be used as tools to build this empathy? And I also would like to learn more about the concept of Ubuntu that you have talked about before, and if that can be applied in this context.
Yes, I think I would answer your questions by also acknowledging what Bonnie has been saying. I think he said that he talks a lot about insularity, because if you start to talk about racism, then it becomes antagonistic. So I think that whilst it's important to talk about all these issues from insularity, but I think we should not shy away from talking about racism. We should not shy away, because if we look at EU, two reports being black in Europe, if we put Finland amongst the most racist in Europe, three countries. So if Finland is becoming part of the most racist, it means we are losing our global responsibility as one of the most equal society. So we are actually going in a very negative direction. I think we have to come to develop some comfortability in talking about uncomfortable topics like racism, and not see it as antagonistic, but see it as a problem that we all need to solve. Because immigration is not a new thing. Immigration is not a new thing. This has always been happening. There are many people in Finland who came from other places. Even those people who call themselves Finnish now, some you hear saying, my ancestors came from Germany, or came from Indonesia, or came from... So it has been a normal thing. I've looked at birds, you know, there are stocks that fly every year from Finland back to Africa, and then they come here to Finland in summer and so forth. So if we bear can fly and move from one continent to the other, why should we try to create these borders that we say these other people should not come in? So I think we need to make even the society comfortable with talking about racism, because if we don't, then it's like what Bonnie has been saying, that we are going to have a crisis of maintaining the social welfare that we have, because mm-hmm. we will not have the workers. I think there's a lot of research that is talking about problems of fertility that the West is having, and we need workers to sustain a social welfare system. So we need to talk about this, but I'm also optimistic because we have a government right now, despite all its problems, but at least they've openly articulated that they are working on anti-racism project as a government, which is under in the Prime Minister's office. So I think that is a good thing, because it starts opening the discussion, and it starts making people a bit comfortable to talk about racism, because if you ask everyone when they are talking about they don't want immigrants, no, immigrants are destroying our society, or fearing the fear of immigrants, there's a certain group that they are mostly afraid of. And the black people are the most first target, because they are very visual. You can quickly see that, okay, this is different. This person is different. So we need to make it comfortable. I've been talking a lot about making difference become the norm. We need to be comfortable with difference. It's a beautiful thing. When we put flowers in our vases, we like different colors, we like different shapes and so forth, because it is beautiful, and it is it brings diversity, and it brings progress, and it brings different talent. So I just wanted to comment on this this uncomfortability to talk about racism. And then I would like also to comment on what Frank was talking about. What I liked is that he started talking about going to the indigenous, reclaiming indigenous knowledge systems as a way of building a different economic system. This brings me to the idea of Ubuntu that you are talking about. I think we need to reclaim or to create space for different kinds of knowledges. And when we create space for different kinds of knowledges, then it is going to open up people to different ways of being, or different ways of relations or relationality. I teach a course, for 7 years I've been teaching a course on contemporary research, decolonizing knowledges at Helsinki University. And it has been one of the popular courses, because students want to know about different kinds of knowledges. Even though in academia there's a focus on the West, the curriculum is their focus on the West, there's lecturers, the researchers, everything is focused on a certain group of people. But students want diversity. They want to have knowledge about other knowledges. Dolf Gacheni, who is a decolonial thinker that I like a lot, has been talking about the epistemicide of knowledges, of indigenous knowledges. This epistemicide, or the killing of other knowledges, has deprived the humanity of valuable knowledge that we could have used, because we have based all this colonial modernity on "I think, therefore I am," from the Western concept of individualism, which also Bonnie has been talking about, and how it has impacted, and how capitalism is very central in it, and everyone is just a machine that is to fuel this capitalist system, without thinking about the collective or the interconnectedness. So interconnectedness of the people, interconnectedness of the countries, we are very much interconnected. And Ubuntu African philosophy it can contribute in understanding the interconnectedness that we are. And I think social media and technology is now showing us live what Africans long back have always known, that we are interconnected. And when we talk about it, when Africans talk about interconnectedness, they are talking about that I am because we are. So I am because we are. There's no person who builds themselves to be who they are. There's a collective that makes us to be who we are. And when we think from that, it's actually a different way of thinking from "I think, therefore I am." The Western notion that "I think, therefore I am." So I am an individual, and my individual interests are the most important. And the concept of the survival of the fittest, the hyper-masculine that we are seeing now, that brings in domination and subjugation and dehumanize other people. Ubuntu, African philosophy, brings in another way of thinking about the world. if I say I think, therefore I am, then I'm focused on myself. But if I say I am because we are, the African philosophy, then I become aware of many other connections that make us who we are. If we say we are Finnish people, we are Finland. Yes, we are Finland. But we are Finland because we are interconnected with so many other countries. The characteristics of this African philosophy of I am because we are, it brings in the understanding that we are interconnected as humans. We are interconnected with the environment. We are interconnected in everything that we do. So if we understand that, we are interconnected with even the environment, then we are not going to push the conquering of the environment or the extractivism from the environment. We know that it's a part of us. We are interconnected with it. We can't survive without what is happening in the environment. So then it actually allows us to deal with this global crisis. If we think from that perspective, then we would not have created the global crisis or the climate global crisis. We would have been thinking in a different way. So I think from Ndlovu Gacheni, Achille Mbembe, Obiama Nyameke, they are talking about opening up the knowledge systems so that we can allow all the knowledge system to have a conversation with each other. And then we can see what emerges without one way of thinking dominating in the global economy of knowledge.
Thank you, Dr. That was really, really interesting, actually. I mean, my mind started going everywhere, I think, to think of what the past 100 years would have been like if these different types of knowledge had the chance to develop before the Industrial Revolution. How would have societies have developed if they had been in peace without colonialism? How would have these different places developed if they had just had a chance? But would you, Bon and Frank, like to comment?
I'm intrigued by my co-panelist's theory of racism, the theory that internationalism and globalism and understanding and mutual coexistence can address racism. It's a theory that could be verified empirically. London, Tokyo, and New York, among the most globalized of all cities in the world. And yet they are also the most racist. Australia is considered a highly cosmopolitan society, country. And yet racism is persistent. So I'm unsure about your theory of racism and how it might be addressed.
Yes, I think Kimberly Crenshaw has given us the theory of intersectional theory. It helps to understand why we have, and she's an American, and she came up with this theory when she was trying to explain why Black women, the most poor and the affected a lot by poverty. She's a legal scholar. She brought into this discussion intersectional theory that capitalism, like Bonnie has been saying, is one of the main pillars. And then she brings in gender as the second pillar. And then she brings in race as well as the third pillar. And then it has been developed now by others, building on what Kimberly Crenshaw has started with, having those three main, she had three main tenets of intersectionality. So if you look at those three main tenets just at the basis of Kimberly Crenshaw, you can understand why you can have a cosmopolitan city like New York and all the Australia and all this. There is capitalism is central there. And we know, like US, slavery was very central in building that huge capitalist system. People had to go there as slaves. And the main reason was they wanted the labor. And even now, that's why there's this talk that we want qualified immigrants. We want skilled immigrants. It's now you can only come as a slave to come and work for us. So it's another form of recreating different ways of slavery. But let me not move away from this explanation of intersectionality. So then you have, so the race comes in as well, because it remains, because this capitalist system, it needs to be fueled by different aspects. You need workers, and these workers, that's why you heard that when they were in the US, there were elections, they were saying they are stealing black jobs. There was this saying of black jobs. So everyone was wondering, what are black jobs? Because these black jobs are the ones that are steering the ship of capitalism. So you can't do away. Then race, you can already see from these black jobs, there's race already playing out there, that the capitalist system needs a lot of divisions to fuel it and to sustain it. It's an institution. All these are just institutionally interconnected. And to sustain that, race plays a very important role. I think that you cannot underestimate the role of race in sustaining capitalism. And you can also not underestimate the role of race and gender in also sustaining this capitalist system. It's a violent system that needs constant sustainability and fuel. And race plays a central role. And at any moment, there will be talk about race. What kind of labor do you want? There will be even stratification of that kind of labor, where it is coming from. And the other places, they will not want workers from there, even if they are educated, unless they are coming for black jobs.
Well said. Would you like to comment on before we have our break?
Yeah, in principle, we agree that racism is the real issue and trickier than capitalist inequality. But for me, I'm concerned about the strategy of communication. What will be a starting point? Because if you look at human beings' behavior, why they tend to be racist, well, one, the most prominent analysis they would say is because of hatred. But there are so many also who are just ignorant.
Mm.
So we address hatred and ignorance. For those who are just naturally haters, it's difficult to talk to them already. But those who are just ignorant, we can communicate and create a space for dialogue. And then if you problematize insularity, the strategy is for how to make those with racist tendencies and behavior to communicate with you and have a global perspective, which is the global perspective is basically equated to the African concept of Ubuntu, which I understand as there's a you in I and an I in you. And what is that global universal perspective is our own humanity, we as a human being. And that must be highlighted in this kind of communication. In my observation also lived experience, coming from the global South, non-white, living and being educated for more than 15 years now in this part of the world. My observation is that there are different types of racists. I already mentioned to you the most difficult are just the haters.
Mm-hmm.
Who even form movements, they become neo-Nazis, white supremacists. But there are also types according to their general tendencies and behaviors. So the classic ones we know in development studies would be the imperialist, the old European colonizers, and then the liberal internationalists of the United States. They are imperialists.
Mm.
So they would like to impose their own culture and worldview on the other, their own superiority. Yeah. But racism has also evolved in recent years. It's clearly manifested. If you look at the right-wing parties in Finland, they are not so imperialist.
Mm.
Yeah. If you look at Trump and many of the MAGA crowd, many of them are not imperialist racist.
Mm.
Their racism is based on exclusivism. So they are exclusivist. So what do I mean by exclusivism? So in Finland, Finnishness is just us. It cannot be exported. If you're an imperialist, racist Finn, you would like to promote Finnishness all over the world. That is the right way of living. But what we are observing at the very moment is that they are exclusivist. They don't want to export. And Trump crowd also has that kind of tendencies now. Of course, the usual imperialist racism view are continuing. So for me, how can you even make an ally of course, confrontation is there. But for me, also to have a dialogue is very important at this point. Because these are real sensitive issues. So how do you put people in a negotiating table? How to communicate? For example, how to address mass immigration?
Hmm.
It's all right for me that a particular political party in countries of Finland and Europe would be against immigrants. But they should understand pretty well the global dimension, the historical reason of mass migration, and why people from the global south are coming to countries like Finland. I already mentioned these are people fleeing conditions of war, imperialist wars carried on by their allies, politically, economically, and militarily, against people in the Middle East, in the Arab world, in North Africa, and then the neoliberal policies that their allies and then the international institutions, multilaterals that they have invested in, who subjected to further impoverishment, poverty, indebtedness, the third world countries because of the imposition of conditionalities. Okay, so if you agree with the fundamental cause and reason of mass migration, of asylum seekers, of people from different colors and nationalities, why they are here and moving in here. Now, if you have a global perspective, so oppose imperialist wars. Join us in opposing and disciplining the military-industrial big tech complex. Yeah? And then support global economic policies in trade and finance that also give tremendous autonomy to global South countries so that they can organize their economies according to how they perceive a good life is.
Mm.
And also climate change, if they don't understand it's a global phenomenon, is because of inequality. The climate change is actually a cause of rich people, rich countries. And then as Franklin mentioned, you know, the poor countries are the ones suffering. So I think once they have this global perspective and they are being, you know, cleansed from the disease of insularity, now we can move forward. We oppose wars. We oppose those economic policies, Eurocentric economic policies or American exceptional policies that contribute to the underdevelopment of developing countries, and also support climate change effort because now that they have a global and historical perspective.
Thank you.
And also to really understand that there's not a global south is the minority, the global north is the minority, and the global south is the majority.
Mm.
And to understand that this global south has got their own world views. So, and the what we have in Euro-American knowledge system is not the only way of thinking or seeing the world. There can be diversity of knowledge systems that can actually help us to solve many of the problems. I have always got fascinated with the global crisis activism, and to find young women become the voice, the global voice of the climate global crisis. And you look at it and you wonder, Indigenous people have been talking every day about this. They have been fighting for this every day. How come we don't have this global activist from Indigenous people? So I think we need to really go to what Obiama Nemeka talks about, what she calls no ego feminism. No ego feminism is the understanding that removing the ego, that you know everything, and allowing ourselves to interact with different kind of knowledge systems so that we can solve some of these critical issues. But if we continue centering the West, the Eurocentric, that is come with the colonial modernity in the academia, because I talk a lot about the academia because that's where the manufacture of knowledge and all these theories that go into policies come from. Mm. And it's also the creation of knowledge that goes into schools and all that. Mm. The teachers, how teachers are trained and everything. It happened in these institutions. So if these institutions do not open up, I don't know how we are going to solve the most difficult crisis we have, because we cannot solve everything with the Eurocentric colonial modernity and its knowledge systems that it has created. We really have to open up to, we have to start to say, okay, we have created all this with our knowledge system. Can we try to find something else? If we really want to solve the climate crisis, maybe now is the time to go to Indigenous people. Here in Finland, you just go to Sami people. They really know how to solve all these problems. Mm. But you find one thing, you will never see a Sami person being the global celebrity of the climate crisis. So I think, like you talk about this insularity, I think it's a very interesting theory that the insularity is even happening at knowledge level. Mm. Who is allowed to create knowledge? Mm. And who is allowed to distribute knowledge? How is that knowledge distributed? Mm. And to whom? Because of that insularity. So we really need to think of opening up. And Ubuntu, I think, can contribute in this. I'm an advocate of really Ubuntu knowledge system as an African philosophy, because it allows us to be open to knowing that the other has something and the other is not a threat. Mm. Actually, we have a saying in our culture that like a visitor does not finish all the food that is in the granary. In other words, they bring blessings, they bring knowledge, they bring many other things that we might not have. Mm. So if we don't see any visitor or immigrant as a threat, we know that, no, they are not going to finish money from Kela. They are actually going to contribute something. Then we can also bring them into our institutions. Because when we talk about racism, we are not talking only about person to person, yes, interpersonal racism happens between people, but we are more concerned about institutional racism, mm. that is in institutions, that really creates these barriers for access to all these institutions that we have. And if we can work at the institutional level to see how we can open up, for example, how do we open up the academia so that we have diversity? How do we give money for funding to Sami people to work on climate crisis? Most of the time, they are not given that money. It goes to the white Finnish, who are always quickly the experts. You talk about anti-racism or racism. How do we give the funding to some of the communities that are experiencing this so that they can be part of the solution? Most of the time, the money will go to white Finnish academia, and those who are racialized, they will not get it. So how do we make our institutions open up? How do we make a, in a lecture, a sociology lecture, How do we have diversity of knowledge in that curriculum, to the curriculum that we are presenting to students? And if we do that at an intense level, then this insularity that Bonnie is talking about, we can start chopping it out.
Okay.
But if we remain not open to different knowledges, systems, then we cannot open up. Because if we know about Ubuntu, African philosophy, then we will know that about care, we'll know about compassion, we'll know about sharing, because these are the principles of African philosophy. And then we'll know about taking care of the environment, we'll know about not killing animals. You know, I have laughed when there's this push for vegetarian, veganism, because this is what Eurocentric does. They learn something and everyone else must be taught now that you must not eat meat, you must not eat, you must be vegan. I grew up not eating meat. Even when I was in Africa, meat, we had this thing about the eye, when it's like popping up with the eye, you say, we are going to eat meat. Because it's such a delicate delicacy that comes maybe once a month.
Mm.
And I was so shocked, even when I came as an adult to Finland, to see that breakfast, there's cheese, there's cold meat, there's, oh, I said, fish and all this. I said, wow. So now Europeans, we think everyone is eating meat like that. No, because we can't eat meat like that, because meat, most of the animals are our totems. So if it's our totem, you can't eat certain kinds of animals, and you have to take care, because it's a totem. It means it's interconnected with you. This is, you are part of the, if you, for example, buffalo, you can't eat the buffalo. So you already have certain respect of animals.
Mm.
So people wonder when there is this, oh, we are vegan, we are what people wondering, what is that? what is that? So, and we make a lot of imposition of our ignorance to other people.
Mm.
So we go there now and start with telling them, you must be vegan, you must be this. And everyone is wondering, what is this? So we need to open up our knowledge creation centers, so that there can be diversity of knowledge, and we can learn a lot from this and bring these different knowledges. I'm so concerned about what is happening now, because I think we can see that there is a multipolar imaging. And like Bonnie said, if people have had so much power and domination and extractivism for such a long time, are they going to allow us to survive when they lose their power, or they will say, no, if we lose power, we go with everyone?
Mm.
So I'm so concerned that we need people to really start talking a lot about peace, because there is a lot of mobilization about war, about threats and so forth. But no one is really, really making the same noise about peace. And how do we prepare for a multipolar world?
Mm.
Because now it cannot run away from it. It's emerging and it's part of the process, of life process. But are we the Finnish people, the Europeans, are we ready to share power?
Mm.
How do we even know how to share power? And we are so afraid of losing power, so we have to prepare how to share power.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good reminder for us, Faith, that our global perspective and global vision should not only be about the relationship of human beings with fellow human beings, but also the relationship of humanity with animals and other living things in the natural world.
And our shared planet that we all share. And actually...
Indeed.
I'll finish this part of discussion with what came to my mind was, as we were talking about racism, then just the simple fact, as Toni Morrison said, there's only one race and it's the human race. But that's not something that we can even perceive in these discussions where we're so tight into thinking about our own lives and our fears and our economic situation and do you have a job and the basic things that I think are fueling most of these racist discussions, especially in the ignorant portion of the racist.
Yes, but let's continue after a short break and discuss about solutions and then about a world where these solutions would be actually taken or implemented, what such a world would look like. So let's continue soon. Thank you for this.
That's what the weakness of academics.